This week, the Dow Jones Industrials finished at another record close, the highest point in its 117-year history. Welcome, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, here with you for another big show. We've got top interviews and the financial headlines affecting your portfolio. First up, Harry S. Dent joins the show. He says that now that India has abolished the 80-20 rule, which requires 20% of imports to be shipped out as jewelry, and the Netherlands has secretly repatriated 150 tons of gold from the New York Fed, demand is likely to soar. A broad-based economic collapse, though, could be the inevitable result of another bubble in the equities markets. He expects deleveraging to result with a deflationary implosion the likes of which the world has never seen before. And if it sounds extreme, he was one of the few to predict the incredible U.S. dollar rally of this year. And when the dust finally settles, commodities will be the place to be, as well as stocks in emerging countries. Then Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors joins me. We take a hard look at the capital flows driving funds into U.S. equities and the dollar, pushing commodities in the energy sectors around here. We also examine Martin Armstrong, an interesting character in the financial sector who has his own documentary coming out soon, The Forecaster. We outline several futures contract buying opportunities, and he says he sees a turning point in the entire stock market. Plus, the XAU is starting to show some signs of a bottom. And then Robert Ian wraps up this show with another big report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Sunny skies appeared over the gold market this week at Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange. Despite the dollar rally, gold added $26.80, up over 2% for the week, finishing near $1,200. Silver added about a dollar, 5.5% move nearly, closing at $16.28 an ounce, and the XAU and gold and silver indexes added over 2.5%, finishing at $70. Palladium also picked up 3.5, ending over that $800 level. Platinum picked up $23, finishing at $12.23 an ounce. But West Texas Intermediate crude bucked the trend, losing, though, only 36 cents this week, ending at $65.63 a barrel. The top story guiding the precious metal sector this week, continued dollar strength. The greenback rally persisted amid solid employment numbers in the U.S. on Friday. The Labor Department announced a better-than-expected jobs report, which showed solid conditions. 321,000 new jobs were added last month. That was nearly 100% better than expected by economists. The greenback rallied on expectations that the Fed will raise rates while the BOJ and EU held rates low to stimulate economic conditions. Higher rates make stocks more attractive due to dividend yields. In related news, the European Central Bank held its benchmark lending rate at 0.05%, virtually nothing, preferring to wait for the new year to announce additional toxic debt repurchasing plans. Low rates on both the U.S. coasts directs funds into the U.S. bonds as investors and institutions seek out higher returns in the U.S. in dollar-denominated investments. In 2014, the U.S. created the most new jobs since 1999. That's about 15 years. You heard it right. The U.S. creating more jobs since 1999. But are those jobs nearly as lucrative as they were 10 or 15 years ago? Food for thought. Bottom line on the precious metals sector. Although there were signs of buying in gold, particularly the silver market this week, the dollar is blasting through resistance with little trouble, suggesting that the ultimate bottom may not quite yet be in place, so I think patience is advisable. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange for the seventh week running. The Dow added 130 points this week, almost a percent, ending just shy of that 18,000 benchmark. 17,958 was the closing number on Friday, the highest weekly close in its history. The S&P 500 picked up 8, not quite half a percent, ending at 2075, while the NASDAQ dropped 11, closing at 4740. Still looking as though it's on its way to that 5,000 point last seen around the year 2000. The solid payroll number colluded with the October jobless rate of just 5.8%. That's right, unemployment around 5.8%, a perfect melange for higher share prices and corporate profits. Adding to upward momentum, investors tend to favor stocks ahead of the holidays as shoppers loosen their pocketbooks and wallets and their credit cards in that desperate attempt to accumulate more debt. In addition, solid GDP figures indicate that Goldilocks conditions are here again. Not too much inflation, not too much employment, just right for corporate profits. Many top analysts are calling for an early January effect with the equities rally continuing into the new year. Bottom line, on Wall Street. Well, the trusty 7-indicator fear index remains in the greedy category for the second week running, but still not many signs of over-exuberance just yet. The market momentum seems to be carrying the indexes higher, and as they say, don't fight the tape. But when this parabolic market stops moving higher, look out below. For next week's reports and all the new stock candidates, please log into your Alpha Stocks newsletter account. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with top guests. We'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Back, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Nice to be back, Chris.
Investor mentality has changed in just the past few years. A much shorter time frame, and I think this is essential when you start to try to explain your concepts on investing to others. Do you see that the typical investor, their horizon has changed, and how has this impacted your message today?
Well, you know, it has, because the market's been so roller coaster since the tech bubble peaked in early 2000. You know, we've seen crash, and then we've seen bubble again, and then crash, and then now the governments are like pumping everything up, and it's kind of a confusing time, because by our indicators long term, and we said this a long time ago, the demographic surge that was causing this boom with the baby boomers, that was over in late 2007. Ever since then, and the Great Recession, it's been all about governments pumping back up the economy, governments keeping the bubble going. And you know, and at first the gold market's expected, well, gosh, all this money printing is going to create inflation. But we've also been saying for many years is that the trend for the next decade is going to be mostly deflationary, because there's going to be more baby boomers retiring than echo boomers entering the workforce. It is a different time. Something has changed. Governments are not accepting this change. And so to me, it's just confusing investors. Investors don't know what to think when things bubble up and crash again, or when they see the only reason we seem to be making progress is when governments just print a bunch of money. That's not real. And most people know that somewhere down there. So I think it's a very confusing time. And yeah, it's made investors more short-term oriented. And that's not all a bad thing, because I think the markets clearly have more downside than upside over the next several years, so it's better to be cautious.
Speaking of deflation, we saw West Texas Intermediate crude implode over the past few weeks. Clearly, there's a dollar component at play here. Much of the action is a direct result of ECB and the Bank of Japan, as well as the PBOC, colluding to essentially crush their currencies in order to have a Bernanke effect of their own. So clearly there's quantitative easing on both sides that has helped. Did you really expect such an eruption? Do you concur that a big component here is the central banks crushing their currencies to support their economies?
Well, you know, Chris, the bigger picture is that the U.S. dollar devalued from 1985 to early 2008, 58% during the boom. We flooded the world with dollars. Trade deficits, foreign exchange reserves out there to other countries. We ran up more debt than anybody else. And so when we started to hit this change in the economy, we got more deflation from, you know, our debt deleveraging. Now, that's the broader view. We're looking for the dollar to go up for years. But yes, in recent times, what's happened is we also look at demographic trends, and Europe's demographics are aging faster than the U.S. Japan started aging back in the 90s, and we predicted that downturn because of their demographics. And so since their economies are weaker, they are having to print more money, quantitative easing, to keep their economies from falling into deflation or falling into recession or depression than we are. We're printing money up until recently, but they're printing more. And in Japan, really went off the charts, printing money starting in early 2013, and now we've just seen, just as the U.S. tapered off, we've seen the ECB step in, and their economy is on the verge of recession. Italy is in recession. Germany is right on the cusp of recession. So is France. And the only countries doing half good over there are countries like Greece that have gotten so many bailouts, they've gotten relief. So it's a long-term and a short-term picture. Short-term, clearly, the biggest reason for the change in the last several months is, yes, we're being outprinted by our major trading partners.
And there's been some interesting developments, I think you'd agree, in the last week or so. In particular, unlike the Bundesbank, the Netherlands had very little difficulty receiving most, if not all, of their gold reserves from the New York Fed. And this is, I think, quite interesting, not only from a geopolitical standpoint, but also for our community in general. They had something like 150 tons of gold repatriated, whereas the Bundesbank has only had the pleasure of 5 tons.
I'm not in the camp that says we're going to have to return to a gold standard. We need a standard, but there is not enough gold to really back currencies in this age where information technologies are growing much faster than natural resources. So I mean, that's one thing. But on the other hand, I've just been watching gold. We've been predicting for the last couple of years that gold would fall and would fall, because we're in a deflationary era, not an inflationary era, despite all the money printing. But despite saying that, to me, recently it's looked like gold has been trying to find a near-term bottom, that they broke through some key support around 1180. You would have thought gold would have fallen apart. It looks like, to me, it's trying to put in a bottom here. It's kind of zigging, zagging up and down. And I think the selling is probably over for now in gold. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see gold bounce to somewhere between 1300 and 1400. But I still see the trend more down than up over the next couple of years, because I see commodities in general. We've been saying, along with Louis Mavalier and a bunch of people, that you've got this broad trend that nobody's noticing, that the global economy is slowing down, not just Europe, but the global economy in China and emerging countries. And it's largely because commodities keep weakening, partly because of a rising dollar, but partly because of slowing. And when those commodity exports weaken for these emerging markets, they slow down. And when they slow down, China slows down, because they're exporting to everybody, including emerging markets. So we have this kind of vicious cycle of commodities falling, emerging markets slowing, and emerging markets have all the demographic strength. All of the developed countries have slow demographics, including the U.S. We're just not as bad as Europe or Japan. So this whole thing is kind of like a pernicious thing that we see continuing over the next several years, that world's going to slow, commodities are going to fall, and that's going to actually hurt emerging markets more than it hurts developed in some ways. And so I'm looking for a good bounce in gold, maybe for several months, but I still think gold is more headed down. And, you know, we've been saying for years, dollar headed up, gold and commodities heading down. That's been one of our key trends.
It's an interesting dichotomy. On the one hand, we have what should be the perfect recipe for solid precious metals. I mean, a global banker's throwing money from helicopters and launching it actually up into the air in ICBM missiles. But on the other hand, the trend is lower, and you've outlined many solid reasons why. I would recommend that people use weakness as an opportunity to build up a portfolio of precious metals reserves, because the end game here can't be very positive for currencies. I mean, that might be 5-10 years down the road, but ultimately, wouldn't you say there's a day of reckoning?
Well, the end game's not really good for anything, Chris. That's our view, that people don't understand that once in a lifetime, you get what we call a winter season. You have a big bubble boom. Everything bubbled up, including gold and commodities in recent years, and stocks and real estate and everything around. And when these bubbles finally burst, they're driven by death, driven by speculation, strong trends and stuff. Everything goes down. I mean, currencies get hit, a lot of currencies get hit, commodities get hit, real estate gets hit, stocks get hit. We had a similar thing happen in the 1930s. And so to me, it's not a good end game for anything. And money printing normally would be positive gold, no question about it. But in this case, governments are feverishly printing money to replace the demographic growth that's disappearing and debt that's being deleveraged slowly. It would be deleveraging much faster. So we've got a broader processing going here that is working towards deflation, and we would have much greater deflation if it weren't for so much money printing. So central banks, we're fighting the inevitable, and it's not a good outcome for anything. I think we're going to have a much deeper, broad-based economic collapse in the next 2 to 5 years that most people don't expect. Most people say, oh, we've seen the worst of it, and governments won't let that happen again. Governments are creating an even bigger bubble than before, and even greater debt and greater imbalances in our economy, and our economy is going to have to balance this back out. And in that process, I think gold will go down farther than one of these days when it's $250 to $400 an ounce. I'm going to be in there buying with both fists, because longer term, you're going to have an inflation trend again, and you're going to have emerging markets driving our economy more than developed, and they are huge commodity and gold consumers.
With regard to the precious metals, yes, on a nominal basis, we've seen quite an interesting rally 2002 to 2012. But on a real basis, gold is virtually where it was in 1980, you know, over 30 years ago. You could find ample evidence to show that the yellow metal holds up quite well during deflationary implosions and actually can even move sharply higher. There could be the beginning of a hyperinflation, not a deflation. And if you look at the Weimar example in Zimbabwe and several others, Venezuela, Argentina, over the past, let's say, 100 years, you see the stock markets take off with a vengeance, and they never abate. They continue ad infinitum higher, taking everything else up with them.
Well, again, we look at broader trends, Chris, and the Weimar Republic, that whole blowout came at the end of just after World War One, when they'd lost the war, Germany, and they were incredibly in debt and bankrupt. And then the winning countries, the Allies, put reparations on them. They had to print money to get out of there, but that was at the tail end of an inflationary era that actually peaked about 1920 for most countries and 23 for Germany. The 30s was a deflationary era. This is a deflationary era. We have never seen governments so concertedly print money and continue to print money year after year after year after year and still have low inflation or mild deflation. We're in a deflationary era. I think somewhere down the road you might could get hyperinflation, but not in this circumstance. The world's everything, the aging of developed countries is deflationary. Commodity prices falling is deflationary. High debt deleveraging, bubbles bursting, all of this is deflationary. It destroys money. And so, again, I just say governments are, it's just the fact that they're printing so much and we're having so little inflation, and the gold is not bouncing stronger, shows you that there's a deeper fundamental trend, and it's all about deflation. And when this thing finally cracks and governments basically lose this battle for keeping the bubbles going, and the bubbles burst anyway, and I think China's the biggest bubble that could start something, a snowball running downhill that no central bank could stop, when that happens, you're just going to have worse deflation to make up for all the reflation and denial. This is just denial to say, oh, we had the greatest debt bubble in history. We encouraged the greatest speculation in history, stocks, real estate, commodities, everything. And we just won't let the bubble fall because it would hurt too much.
We have very similar viewpoints, but we're coming to conclusions from very different angles. I mean, you have over $250 billion in notional derivatives floating around the world, holding up this edifice that appears to be solid and stable. To me, it's built on a very shaky foundation that ultimately ends poorly. A situation that looks like deflation, but from my perspective, it's just classic disinflation. An inevitably tsunami of inflation that strikes like a thief in the night.
And then as they did, that the commodities and the precious metals market would be an incredible long-term buy.
I mean, of course, you know, I'm biased at any level. If we look at it on any context, just the Dow to gold ratio or any ratio you want to use, especially in real terms, no portfolio, I think, could suffer from having a good solid 10, 15, 20% foundation in the precious metals. Let's move on now to the retail sales number. We're seeing Walmart, which was leading the Dow higher, just an explosive move. The number is just not so solid. Is that an indication of slow growth to you? Or is this just an anomaly?
Well, you know, one of the things we, again, demographics tells us a lot of things. It tells us car sales are going to start to fall over the next couple of years. Germany's going to underperform in Europe, even though they appear to be the strongest country, just because of the different demographic cycles they're in. Well, what we've had here in the U.S. is we've had the top 10 to 20% doing better than ever, especially with bubbling markets, and they own all these financial securities. And they have lower unemployment, all these things. They're benefiting from all this stimulus. The person isn't much better off, if any, than they were at the tech peak in 2000 or when the Great Recession started in 2008. So I think what's happening is when you look at internet sales and high-end sales, they're doing well. But the everyday person, Target and Walmart, really haven't been doing that well for a long time. But we see that the affluent people, they're the last to peak in their spending because their kids go to school longer, they go to school longer, their whole life cycle peaks later. They're set to peak right here in late 2014, and they're going to go off a cliff like between 2007 and 8. So I think even this affluent strength is going to start to dissipate in the next year or two, and so are car sales, especially upper-end car sales. And Germany is going to keep surprising the downside of the next few years. So the demographics only work against central banks here. And I think they're going to get caught with their shorts down here. And I think they're going to have these bubbles, the economy turn against them despite unprecedented stimulus. And then we're going to see what happens, how much deflation versus this or that. But I agree with you one thing. This cannot end well. And if it does, if we go to the next 5 years and don't see a major financial crisis, I am going to quit my profession.
Please don't do that. With regard to affluent investors, and as a group, I agree with you, they've certainly benefited the most here. But I'd really like to know, without any fear-mongering here, are we looking at something similar to early 1930s? Is this going to be a Great Recession with a vengeance? Part two, could we see something similar, as I said, to the early 1930s? What do you see on the horizon?
It's going to be better if we see something like the 1930s because it'll take the bubbles and the debt out of our economy quickly, and that's what happened there. And we came screaming out of that. The other scenario is what we've seen in Japan. Japan has continued to see their real estate and their stock markets go to lower lows and slowly deleverage, but they never had a banking crisis. They never wrote off debt. And so their debt is higher than ever. You can't keep aging and going in the future with higher and higher debt and have it end well. So Japan's had this, we're just going to keep stimulating and worry about it later. I call it a coma economy. That is the worst scenario to me because you never come out of that coma. Japan has never come out of that coma 23, 24 years after their bubble started to burst. And we came out of that coma, started to come out of that coma 3 years after our bubbles burst in the early 30s because we let the system detox, clean itself of debt and speculation very rapidly. Banks failed very rapidly. Businesses failed. Commodity prices came down. Bubbles burst. You know, all this sort of stuff. It was painful, and everybody's trying to prevent that pain, but I see it ending more like the 30s. But it's a question of central banks have to lose control of the economy because thus far, every time bubbles burst, they just ramp them right back up again. They just throw more money in. And the speculators go for it. And I tell you right now, investors are really cocky. Investors, you can tell by their behavior, even when we have the corrections, They may not buy, but they don't sell. Nobody thinks the Fed will let this stock market go down more than 10 or 20 cents. I think the richest people in this country are going to be the ones that get hit the hardest when this financial bubble finally blows. Not much money in stocks. It's the top 1 to 10% that own all these financial bubbles.
No, it's exactly right. The middle class is just not participating in this rally. And interesting to me, the retail side of this rally is very low. I mean, not like we saw in, as we mentioned, 2000, earlier equities bubble. Now, maybe that will change. Maybe we will see the retail investor come back in. And that, of course, would be a great sign of a top. But I think you're right. Ultimately, there has to be a big correction here at some point. But I don't see that occurring in the foreseeable future. I think this is going to continue to pull more and more funds and capital around the world because most of the banks have taken the central bank money. They have very few places to park that cash that's productive. You're earning negative rates in the ECB right now, and it looks like it's only going to get worse there. Where can you put those funds and feel confident? I think a lot of it's being directed into stocks.
It is. The stocks look the best, especially U.S. large cap stocks. That's the best play right now. But that's where everybody's running. That's where the next crash is going to come. It's guaranteed. They ran into tech stocks. When that failed, they ran into real estate and flipping houses. When that failed, they ran into gold and commodities. And that failed. I mean, you just keep jumping lily pads to new bubbles. Every bubble's going to burst until the whole thing bursts. There is a point where there are no more bubbles, and finally, the central banks can't pump it up anymore. Finally, investors lose confidence. Finally, the bubbles burst despite stimulus because it takes more and more to have less and less of.
Can you give us a precedent in the last century, or you can go back as far as you like, as ancient Greece or Rome, where this scenario you outlined, and I'd like to be able to juxtapose that with what we're seeing currently?
Now, Chris, there's really not, because we've lowered interest rates to cushion downturns. We've never just printed trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars, except in war periods like World War II, to keep bond rates down. I'd say the closest precedent I would see in the early 1700s, when the stock market was young, France and England had spent tons of money in war. They were huge in debt. And what both governments tried to do was sell land they had in America or sell shares they had in trading companies that they'd helped funded to the public, and they financed this with low-cost loans, and they basically created a bubble, and it was the South Seas bubble and the Mississippi land bubble in France, South Seas in England. Both these bubbles burst in 1720, and I mean, they didn't just burst a little. They were down 99%, and so that thing, that literally caused a 67-year bear market in stocks in Europe. I mean, that was the bubble of bubbles, and governments helped create it. So that was what I call an artificial bubble. You know, the growth trends had already peaked, but since governments were desperate from racking up such huge war debts from decades and decades of war between England and France, they came up with this central bank-like scheme to basically create money out of nothing, and it blew up on them. It took 70 years to get back.
If everything does implode, all these markets, equities, real estate, commodities, virtually everything implodes, and we're all looking around, there's nothing but smoke, okay? There's not even fire. It's just all over. The whole house of cards implodes.
Farmland's in a bubble. Farmland's gone up 7-8 times in the last decade or two. It's as big a bubble as the NASDAQ was. So everything's bubbled. See, to me, I'd rather be in cash and safe stuff, wait for these bubbles to burst, and then you're selective. Then you say, you know what I really want to buy when I think everything's, I want to buy commodities and I want to buy emerging countries, because emerging countries are going to have the demographic trends behind them after this global crash, and commodities are going to be driven by those very emerging countries. We might see the biggest commodity boom in history, but it may be 6-7 years before they bottom out with all this deflationary trend. But at the bottom, you could buy anything and do well. But I say commodities and emerging markets will be the best things to buy if we just have an across-the-board rally.
Outline, though, why you see emerging economies, why you see peripheral nations like the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, South Africa, China. Why would these countries be the go-to investments of the post-crash world?
Because they have all the young people. We're aging. We've already become urban. We've already become middle class and upper class. they're still in the early stages of becoming middle class in most of these countries. Most of these countries are still moving people from rural to urban areas. India is only 33% urban. Now, China's like 58%, so they're farther along the line. They've overbuilt. So I'm less bullish on China. But if we saw an all-out rout, India would be one of the first places I'd buy. And guess who are the big consumers of gold in the world? Indians.
Right, and not to mention they just dropped that 80-20 rule. So, of course, now banking industries and financial institutions can import as much as they like without having to export 20% in the form of jewelry. So this, of course, is a big demand component on the horizon. Very well said. Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time today, but it's always a pleasure having you on the show. We'll look forward to having you back on GoldSeek.com Radio.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
Bob Hoy, Editor-in-Chief Investment Strategist of InstitutionalAdvisors.com. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Good to be with you, Chris.
Great to have you back. And, you know, we were discussing this concept of global warming. You know, in just the past month or so, at least in my area and much of the United States, we've had record cold, actually one of the coldest Novembers in national history. We were regularly hitting around 12, 13 degrees here. The idea of mini ice ages, a mini ice age actually seemed to coincide with the bubonic plague.
Well, I did do a degree in geophysics and then went into mining exploration work. But within that, when you took it, there was, the new that ice ages came and went, weren't happy with the mechanism behind the ice ages because there was not, the data was sparse, you know, not enough to, say, get into any cause and effect. And I remember one lecturer sort of saying, well, one theory here is that the Bering Straits are open and the Arctic Ocean stays open and that provides enough humidity. So then you precipitate out on land and turns to ice and snow and then eventually into a huge ice sheet. And that was considered some kind of a random thing. And then the other was the guy, who Milankovitch, who came up and said, hey, this is all going to be periodic. So you've got all these harmonics and equations and stuff with the orbit of the sun's or the Earth's spin, and then the orbital mechanics around the sun. And but the evidence was too sparse to say whether he was right or not. Now, and I remember at the time, you know, this was 1962. You couldn't say one way or the other, and then, always having an eye for it, you started to see the data coming out of satellite measurements and that sort of stuff. And, yeah, you can go back hundreds of thousands of years, and it pretty well concludes the theory that ice ages are periodic. Then also lately, there's more to just the simple amount of energy being received at the Earth's surface, which varies, then also the amount of energy going out from the sun varies. And then within that, you got these cosmic rays come in, and they are variable due to magnetic disturbances from the sun and changes. So then that relates to the cloud cover. So it's all one great big mechanism.
There's another component to this story, though, that I think is overlooked sometimes, and that is the heat that emanates from the Earth's core. You know, this iron-nickel core is really still something of a mystery. I read some research several months ago with
moving the crust around, and then you've got the huge volcanoes. But the variable, the what really change at surface and above is due to all this orbital mechanics stuff. So anyways, if you talk about the amount of heat being sent out by the sun varying, the amount of heat received at the Earth's surface varying due to its elliptical orbit or the tilt and all that sort of stuff, and then being screened in the middle by the amount of clouds varying, hey, what does 400 parts per million CO2 got to do with it? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. And this has all been invented by some very ambitious people who like control. So, and of course, their recipe is totally absurd, that they can control the climate of the Earth through appropriately timed regulations and taxation. You know, give me a break.
I have a more novel approach of looking at the concept. I actually believe we will find over time that the primary source of heat and energy in the Earth actually emanates from the core, as I mentioned. And this is a direct result of the Einstein-Hirschhorn unification hypothesis that I published about a year or so ago. This is where I get the idea from. And I think that Nassim Hirschhorn did a fantastic job stretching the limits of astrophysics when he came to the startling conclusion that it's quite likely that much of our subatomic world are singularities, meaning that there are black holes at the heart of much of the subatomic world, the many, many black holes. I try to stretch it a bit further, and what I believe is what we refer to as gravity is the fact that all atomic particles are actually singularities, particularly protons and neutrons, and of course the quarks and whatnot that make them up. So in essence, I think what geologists will find many decades, if not hundreds of years from now, a conundrum, an enigma at the center of the Earth, of Mother Earth, is a little more intriguing than I think any astronomer has proposed up to this point. And I think we will find that there is an unusual singularity at the center of this Earth. And as a result, a surprising amount of geothermal energy keeps our rock and the water, if you will, the huge oceans of the Earth at just the right temperature. And of course, now that all ties in with, you say, the astromechanical processes. It's an interesting topic and maybe one for another time. The implications, I think, for our listeners are, you know, they need to be thinking about how will my family cope where food is more scarce, produce and whatnot more expensive. All right, well, interesting topic. Let's move on now to the markets. You say you're watching the markets closely and you see some interesting activity.
Yeah, well, one, I guess the one big one in here is, as you mentioned, is the weakness in energy prices. And going back earlier in the year, well, actually back to last December, we were looking for, because, you know, commodities had been generally depressed, and we were looking for what we called the rotation, whereby they would somehow bottom in December, January, and then rally out to the spring somewhere. And they were good. The crude had a good rally. Base metals had a modest rally. And the precious metals exploded right up to being extremely overbought. So from joy in that sort of culminated for most of these things in May and June, and then more specifically on the oil side, they've got the ETF for the oil patch stocks, which is the XLE. And it got up and gave all kinds of technical signals about being overbought. We had upside exhaustion in it, and it was also giving what we call a sequential sell. So that was the stocks. And then crude oil hit a high of 107. And then our view was, on the bigger picture, you had the change in, you know, which is now in the market and all the story about all of the fracking in of tight sands for crude oil and natural gas. So the main theme was that overall you would have this downward pressure in crude oil prices because of the fact that previously, see, natural gas led on the fracking, and then it went from a regime, say, of highs around 12 or 13 to then the washed out low of in the order of 2. So now it's around 4. So the theme has been that crude oil would take this kind of a step towards a new low price level. It wouldn't be in the same percentages as natural gas, but a new, let's call it a new paradigm. And then also from the summer we were talking that it would be very constructive if crude oil prices fell and denied hard revenues to producers and exporters like Russia and then in the Middle East. And reminded that back in the 80s, Reagan played that game with the Saudis, that on a natural decline in crude oil prices, they would not help out trying to keep it from declining And the crude $34 down to $10 in about 6 months. So, and that then really changed the Soviet Union. Now you've got Putin trying to do a neo-Soviet empire, and denying him lots of money would be a very good thing, which seems to be working out. So now, actually, when we hooked up on this call, I was just doing our section on crude oil, and it is getting very oversold. We had on seasonal work a target of around December for a low. And then you look back on previous crashes in crude oil, like in 2008. When was another one? Oh, 96 or something like that. But at any rate, the crash can run 6 to 7 months, which puts us into somewhere like December or January. Now, the other thing with this, with crude oil, is you don't get a V-bottom down and then straight up. It takes a couple of months of work to establish a bottom.
You know, you'll recall back in 2008, we did get a V-bottom. I mean, of course, that was an extreme event, say 147 roughly, on the futures contract, light sweet crude. And then, of course, West Texas Intermediate crude just slammed down to almost $30, month after month after month of selling, roughly 7 or 8 months of selling. And then you had a nice V-bottom, as you mentioned.
Yeah, but if you look at it on a big chart, but it took a couple of months at the bottom. This is our prospect here. We're looking for an important bottom for crude, and that would include the oil patch stocks, somewhere in the next 7 or 8 weeks. And it has, before one wants to enter it, unless you're a very quick trader, one wants to have it stabilized and double bottomed and who knows what all. But anyways, it's going to take a number of months. Now, this also is the way we look at. Oh, by the way, there's one commodity sector that we got to be positive about, and that's the grains. The symbol, the ETF is the GKX, and it, well, the big high was in 2011, and all the way down there was a couple of good rallies in between. On 1 year there was a drought, and there was going to be no crops, that sort of story. But it bottomed 4 or 5 months ago and has really been acting well, coming up step by step. And last week, we were a little concerned that if it didn't break, that index didn't break above 327, it might take a long rest. About a couple of days ago, it got up to 329. So we're saying there's no signs that this recovery in agricultural prices.
Just a little proviso, even a caveat. If we decompose the grain sector, oats are really struggling here. In fact, if you look at it on a monthly chart, you'll see a classic out of Edwards and McGee head and shoulders pattern there, carving out what appears to be a neckline at the very right shoulder. If that breaks, if we break below last month's low on oats, I just want to warn our listeners that we have a few futures traders in this audience, and anything below 299, 300 on oats is going to be the death knell.
Chris, I'm going to look up and see whether oats is in that ETF, but we just use it. Sometimes we will, when a move in an item gets extremely overdone, like recently feeder cattle got to the moon, and it gave all kinds of technical signals here, so we're looking for a top there. A few years ago, it was coffee, these sort of things. So whenever we see them, we'll just do a one-pager on it. Now, why we like doing them is because markets like these, the big boys at the central banks are not trying to manipulate them. So you got an honest market. Feeder cattle to the moon. What did we do? We had the cows over to the moon. So, and it shows that technical analysis can work. And then now we got, so also we've been looking for an important low in copper around November. Seems to be working on it. And then the base metal ETF is the GYX. And we think it can sort of bottom here in the next number of weeks and do a rally into the first quarter.
A little side note here on copper, trying to carve out a bottom here, but it's still precarious. We really broke down around $3. As I'm sure you remember, it was a brutal sell-off last month. And now we're rallying up, I think, bumping up against resistance. If this month's lows can hold, what a great rally level for a new, unfortunately, due to this incredible dollar strength, all commodities, with very few exceptions, they're going to be struggling, I think.
That recipe's there, but then we also, for this week, just did our work on the dollar index side exhaustion on it on a weekly basis. Well, actually, we had one in early October, and now this is, if the dollar index stays up for tomorrow, because we're doing week to week, then we've got another weekly upside exhaustion on the dollar index. So in post-bubble world, has a tendency to, for the senior currency to be chronically strong against most currencies and most commodities for most of the time, but it got overdone here.
Take a good look at the monthly greenback chart. Peak of 2009, we have yet to eclipse that. That's our current resistance level. Although it's not sexy in the precious metals sector, this is a big dollar story. People just don't want to hear about it, but then we have a lot of sharp folks in this crowd. Tell people why or why not you see the dollar breaking above those 2 points of the past and why they're so critical here.
Yeah, overbought now. Who knows how long it'll take to get rid of the overbought. But here's the way it works, is that in previous post-bubble contractions, let's step one back. In previous great bubbles, in the last couple of bubbles, 29 and more recent, it's London or New York's been the financial center and the dollar's the senior currency. But on previous bubbles, the financial center was London and the currency was sterling. And here's the pattern, is that in the mania of a bubble, people buy debt recklessly, they reach for yield, and at the same time, corporations and countries sell debt that couldn't be able to sell debt like that without a mania in the financial market. So then you have sobriety arrives, and the people have borrowed all of the money have to pay it back. Mm-hmm. And if you're contracted on the security that you floated, you have to pay that normally. If it's written in the financial capital, you're due and payable in the financial capital in senior currency. So where it used to be London and sterling, it's now New York and dollars. So let's just pose one. Let's say, without looking at the numbers, but during this ongoing bubble, that 60% of the debt was floated in New York. So then you stop the bubble, then the whole issue becomes paying it back. So each one of those borrowed dollars that has to be repaid is, in effect, a short of dollars. So such a bubble ends up being a huge short of the senior currency.
I want to float another concept here and like to hear your thoughts. You know, you may be familiar with Martin Armstrong, quite a colorful character. We've had email correspondence here over some time. Plan to have him on the show hopefully soon. An interesting documentary that looks like it's going to be a surprisingly big documentary about his life, hitting the movie theaters, or at least the documentary theaters soon, The Forecaster or something along that. And it basically shows how he found a cycle based on pi, 3.14, one of those irrational numbers that goes on to infinity. As far as we know, there was a comment made by a philosopher. He was using pi to decipher one of the wonders of the universe, that real numbers actually do not exist, only the integers. But it's interesting. Do you know that no number has actually been measured in the real world beyond 20 decimals? And we're measuring pi now with computers into the billions. It takes infinite energy to extend much beyond 20 decimals. Try to wrap your mind around this for one moment. If it takes all the energy in the universe to measure much beyond 20 decimals, what hope do we ever really have of ever identifying a true irrational number like phi, 1.618? Euler's number, 2.71. And then, of course, the most famous, pi 3.14. Anyway, we're getting into numbers theory. I don't mean to do that. Martin Armstrong, I think, has done just a fantastic job. Just gotten so much negative press that people outside the United States revere this man. And he's actually met with most of the royalty in London, for instance. And one of the interesting things with Martin Armstrong's analysis is he, I think, better than anyone else, has encapsulated these global capital flows. And what he's found in these capital flows is that you really see Japan and you see the ECB with their nearly negative rates or negative rates just forcing global capital into the United States. And of course, we are all familiar with that with the U.S. equities market, but I'd like to hear your thoughts into how important is that a component in this U.S. dollar rally?
Reminds me of 1929. Either the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times noted there was a massive inflow of offshore money coming in to play New York. Now, also recently, when we thought the dollar was going to rally, it would be on credit contraction. And the contraction did start for lower-grade issues in June. But as anybody could see, once the violence started in October and was over, then the world was buying New York stocks in New York and driving the dollar up. So this is where it becomes important now to understand that the dollar index is very overbought. So what's going to happen to those recent traders who piled into the big stocks in New York? Now, the other thing we have, as of this week on Apple, which is the biggest capitalization, we now have, now on our upside exhaustion models, you run it daily, weekly, and monthly. And it's not often that you get all three of them. So when it happens, we call it a trifecta, like in horse racing. As of this week, Apple has registered a trifecta. And well, the last time it did it, and I can't remember when that was, but it was many years ago, the decline started within a couple of weeks.
Probably one of our best picks of the year. That along with Domino's Pizza. And I know people are laughing. They hear DPZ, Domino's Pizza. But they had that global expansion, making them one of the best picks of the year. People don't want to hear about it, but it's great. And I'm impressed that your models picked up on it. What I'm seeing here is a potential diamond pattern setup. In fact, it's a classic out of Edwards and McGee decline after a long, long ascent. And now we have a long upper tail on the daily. I mean, I could see a diamond pattern setting up here and finishing the move for good. There's one problem with that theory, though. We have in the monthly and the weekly charts just the most remarkable amount of strength. Do you suspect this is the ultimate zenith?
All I'm saying is that on any of these big stocks, it's very rare, or the index, that you get an upside exhaustion daily, weekly, and monthly. It's out there for your listeners. Do what you do with it. And I'm not going to comment on the company at all. I'm talking about the stock.
I would make one little point here for listeners. It was an $11 stock, and now we're up over tenfold. It's a 10-bagger. As much as it seems to be the Teflon stock pick for hedge funds, I would just maybe heed Bob Hoy's advice. I see some fantastic fundamental developments on the horizon, the wafer technology, the wearable computing, tremendous number of patents in this area, along with Google.
Best just to look at the stock rather than what the company's doing, and... So this, then, is a bellwether for the stock market, perhaps. And we also were halfway into getting another Hindenburg on the overall action on the stock, on the S&P.
Yeah, Bob, this is an interesting indicator. Please tell people, just give them a quick, brief overview.
It shows volatility, a certain pattern of upside, downsides. And we got the first half in, and it might take 3 or 4 weeks to get the other half in. And there's really no point talking about it until the full. But and back in September, it was in, I think we called it a distinctive Hindenburg on that one. So stock markets are up to vulnerable. The one to focus on now is that the Russian yield on their 10-year note is up almost as high as it was in the crash of 2009.
Right.
We're only about 75 basis points away from that. Their one-year note is already at the high yield set in 2009, And so this will eventually spread out. This could be, this should be front page news, but I think it's made it from page 17 to page 6.
Could you maybe, for our precious metals aficionados, tell them just how dollar topping might be a positive, at least in the early part of the new year?
Yeah, well, what we'd do is look at, if people want the habit of the gold bugs, is really just a currency play. It's a play of being long gold or long gold or gold shares against a decline in the U.S. dollar. Now, we're talking about a firmer dollar, so in the long run. So what you have to do is you get down into looking at gold's real price, either deflated by CPI or a PPI, or as we do it, against our own commodity index. Now, gold, the real price of gold goes up in a recession, a post-bubble crash, and then it goes down in the boom. So gold turned, the real price of gold turned up in June of 2007. That signaled the start of that credit contraction. And then right out till February of 2009, it went up to the moon. And I think it was the middle of February when it started heading down. And that led the end of the panic by 3 weeks. Now, this time it's been more leisurely because the real price, as determined by commodities, turned up in June, and it's made a terrific advance. And what that represents is that it's the profitability of gold mining. So you could have gold going, you know, the dollar crashing according to the usual gold bug theory, and you could have gold going to 5,000. But if energy costs and the cost of mining and wages are going up faster than that $5,000 gold, you're not making any money in the gold mining business. So we just look at the real price, and it has started what we think is a cyclical bull market. And once we're take the excesses out of the big stock market, then the gold shares can start to improve. Now, our last sell signal on the gold sector was in May, and we have not had a buy on gold stocks since. And what we're doing here is watching for the gold divided by gold shares divided by gold. Now, that had a low a few weeks ago, popped up, and we're looking for stability in gold shares divided by gold before we really commit to this. So, yeah, traders can nibble away, take a few trades in here, but for the serious longer-term money, we would have the gold shares divided by gold stabilize here for a few weeks more. And then it's the start of what we would take as a cyclical bull market carried by improving profitability of the gold mining industry.
Excellent. I'd like to hear that. Please tell people more about the services you provide and how they can get in touch with you.
Well, you can look at us through our website, institutionaladvisors.com, or you can just Google my name. You know, we write so much stuff, it just comes up. So you just do Bob Hoye, B-O-B-H-O-Y-E, and then you get into our site. And we have an introductory trial, people, basically about 5 or 6 weeks. You get the same research we send out to financial institutions and high net worth accounts and all that sort of stuff. And then at the end of an introductory period, if you like it, you're on. We find a level for a subscription fee. And if you don't, hey, nice to know you.
We're going to look forward to having you back on the show.
Anytime then, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold. gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
Gold Seek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. For those who believe that the idea of a war between paper assets and physical gold is a bit of an overstatement, one need only watch a brief 23-second YouTube video that was posted this week, in which Mario Draghi was asked a question regarding the allocation of assets for QE, as in quantitative easing. He was asked, what sorts of assets should be included in QE? He responded, my sense is, my recollection is, we discussed all assets but gold. And then the audience of what were likely hand-picked reporters all laughed. Zero Hedge posted the video, which has only shown some 4,000 YouTube views as of this broadcast. The most revealing part of this 23-second video clip is not that Draghi indicated they had discussed all assets but gold. The most revealing part of the video is the laugh by a roomful of supposedly objective financial reporters at that statement. That laugh tells you everything you need to know about how the financial press has been conditioned to think and respond about gold. It's like the break room, the locker room, or the party, where the lone person walks in or out and everyone giggles at them. The group knows or believes something they are not verbalizing or sharing explicitly. They are only sharing implicitly by that snarky little laugh. We've all heard it. We all know what it means. We all know how it hurts. And we all know what's at its root. Plain, unadulterated prejudice. Unspoken financial prejudice that surfaced for just a moment against the one asset that can and will ultimately one day take to task all the paper QE assets that were discussed by Draghi and his group. That one asset, when named, was laughed at by a room full of financial reporters. The tee-hee and ha-ha routine those reporters enjoyed at gold's expense, I'm sure went largely unnoticed by the roughly 4,000 people who watched that YouTube video. It's the only thing I noticed in the 23-second video clip. It speaks to an arrogance and cynicism about the nature of financial reality. A reality that QE has been attempting to outrun since its implementation a half dozen years ago. Gold has stood alone, outside, by itself, for 6,000 years and withstood the test of time. It's been laughed at quite a lot by recently proclaimed modern financial intellectuals the past 40 years. QE, in all of its various forms and incarnations, will eventually burn itself out, along with the meaningless laughter from experts whose expertise is questionable. Because ultimately, in the not too distant future, gold will have the last laugh. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.